to the Coding to Be podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and today we're talking about going from hackathons to building a business with Nick Foyer, one of the creators of Project Owl, a winner of Call for Code.
People that I knew who had families in Puerto Rico did not know if their grandmother was okay and didn't find out until a month and a half later.
Call for Code is a virtual hackathon where developers find ways to reduce the impact of natural disasters through technology. Project Owl is a deployable mesh network, don't worry, we'll tell you what that is, that brings connectivity to survivors of natural disasters. And Nick, along with his co-founder, Brian, were one of the 100,000 developers who competed. Nick tells us about how he went from hackathon hobbyist to building a real-world business that helps people after this. Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your background. Did you always know you wanted to be a programmer?
No, actually, when I was in high school, I thought I wanted to be a researcher, you know, working in a lab, working with petri dishes. And what really inspired me was my grandfather had passed away from cancer. So I really wanted to work in cancer research labs. And that's what I actually did when I went to college. But after the first 2 years of college, I ended up taking a gap year where I worked in a lab for a whole year just to get the experience. And I ultimately realized that that's not really what I wanted to do. And after my gap year, over the summer, I was still planning on continuing my degree since I was already halfway through. But my dad just actually came up to me and said, "Hey, I'm interested in selling vitamins online. You're good at math and science. Just figure out how to set up a website." And I didn't have anything going on that summer. And so I'm like, okay, you know, could be interesting. And when I started, I actually didn't like it that much. But there was a moment, though, when it kind of just clicked for me, where I understood just how powerful coding was, where I could literally do whatever I wanted. As long as I could think of it, I could turn it into code and make an application. At the end of the summer, I actually ended up canceling all of my biology classes and switched my degree to computer science. I did a whole 180, and it's been one of the best decisions I ever made.
So I know that hackathons are a big part of your development. What exactly is a hackathon?
So a hackathon is an event that typically takes around 24 hours over a weekend, where you come with an idea and build something to present to a panel of judges to win prizes.
So how many hackathons have you participated in?
So I've participated in over 60 hackathons across the US and Europe.
So what was the appeal for you? What made you keep going back to hackathons?
The amazing thing about hackathons is that it's always broadening your horizons, where usually at a hackathon, you'll have a couple sponsors, where you'll have a host company, and then they'll bring in a couple other technologies who will come there, and they'll either bring their API or some hardware that they want you to try out. They say, "Here's our API, build something really cool with it." And it was always a great way to try new technology. This is how I learned about Twilio or Firebase or Cloud Functions, serverless. And for me, I always thought it was a really interesting way to try out new technology and build something cool, just build a passion project, or just kind of come up with something crazy or silly, or try out an idea that I had. And the whole thing would just take a weekend. You'd go with a couple of friends and hang out and build something cool. But as it went on, where I started to get a little bit more serious about what I was doing, and also at the time, I started getting better at code, where by the end of the 24 hours, I would actually have a finished product that I was proud of. And at a hackathon, it's not just, oh, you know, just have some fun and build something. usually the companies that host these hackathons, they come with a problem. They say, hey, we have this problem and we want ideas to solve it. And so you're actually working with real needs. So like there's a hackathon at Ernst & Young where they're talking about how do we improve the experience of insurance and for disaster relief. And so for me, I didn't really know much about insurance. But the thing is, at this moment, I knew that, hey, there's a need, there's a problem here, and they're looking for technology to solve it. And so you're able to identify real problems and real needs that you could build a business on.
And Project Owl also similarly solves a need and something that you saw was a problem in not just the community, but kind of in the world. Tell me a little bit about Project Owl. What is it?
I think maybe when talking about Project Owl, it's important to start with IBM's Call for Code. IBM's Call for Code is a global virtual hackathon, a little bit different from the hackathons I was describing where you work on site in some building over a weekend, but it's actually over a longer period of time where you have more time to build your ideas. But it works kind of the same way where you build a team, have an idea, and present it to judges. Call for Code, the problem that they were asking us to solve was disaster relief. And disaster relief is a big problem around the world. And they wanted us developers to help figure out ideas for how we could improve the disaster relief process. So we were inspired by Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. And what really struck us was how Hurricane Maria completely decimated infrastructure where communications were down for so long that people that I knew who had families in Puerto Rico did not know if their grandmother was okay and didn't find out until a month and a half later that they were even still alive. And so we live in an age of technology where I take it for granted that I'm able to at all times be able to contact my family or contact help. And that kind of really, for me, struck me as a situation where what do you do when you have zero connectivity and you can't, there's no one that you can call for help. And so that's why we came up with Project Owl. And Project Owl is a deployable network that connects survivors of natural disasters with first responders in these situations where there is no cellular or internet connectivity.
How does it do that?
How it works, it's an IoT mesh network that utilizes a Wi-Fi hotspot. So it's kind of like imagining walking into Starbucks and connecting to their Wi-Fi. Before you get connected to the Starbucks Wi-Fi, a little page pops up and asks you maybe for your email or some information about you before it connects you. Project Owl works the same way, where you connect to our, we call the devices ducks. You connect to our duck network or Wi-Fi network, and a little page will come up. And rather than asking for your email, we ask for your name, phone number for someone to contact, what your emergency is, and also where are you. And when you submit this message, it travels through our mesh network until it gets to a duck that is connected to the internet, where it sends that information to our cloud platform. And all this data gets put onto a map for first responders so that when they are making decisions on where do they need some supplies or people, they can make more efficient and more timely decisions on where they need to put those resources.
That actually makes a lot of sense. That was a really good explanation.
Thank you.
So it sounds like it still does need the internet, right? There needs to be at least one part, one duck that you called it, that needs to be connected to the internet. So in a natural disaster, how hard is it to find that one duck?
Yeah, so it's a really great question. And it also kind of speaks to one of the design points of our cluster duck. We call it the cluster duck network, that we designed it to be offline first. So that means that if we needed to, this could be completely offline. So if you had one of these devices set up in, let's say, a police station, they'd be able to view in real time all the data coming in through the network on a small terminal to be able to say, okay, this is where we need to go. This is where people in our community need help before they have a Wi-Fi uplink. the duck that is connected to Wi-Fi, we call this actually the Papa duck. This duck will typically be in an area where you'll have your first responders. So this will be in a, maybe a headquarters where they'll set up a satellite uplink to connect to Wi-Fi. Now, also, we're working on with another company called FleetSpace, which actually offers a device where we can actually have like a mobile satellite connection. So this is also be another way for us to be able to send data in remote areas.
So it sounds like with this mesh network, it doesn't necessarily need the internet because the first responders are on that same network. Is that right?
Yes, that's one way that we could use it. But ideally, we would like to have it be connected to Wi-Fi because we have our whole software platform where it makes it a lot easier for us to display the information.
So I want to get into the implementation of the system. How does it actually work? How is it implemented?
So there's two ways that we plan to implement Project OWL. First is disaster preparedness. We would work with local emergency operations centers to set up ducts in the local communities, so or in local counties, with the ducts that are connected to solar panels. This way that whenever a disaster does hit, we have our mesh network already set up. So these would maybe sit on top of buildings or telephone poles. And so that when disaster strikes, we'll be ready. However, when disaster does strike, you never really know what's going to happen. And I'm sure you've seen pictures of all the destruction. So there will be areas where some of these devices might actually get destroyed. This is also one of the beauties of our technology is that they're small IoT devices. The current prototype right now, you can fit in your pocket. And the great thing about a mesh network is that we're able to replace these devices extremely easy. So it's not like a telephone wire or anything like this, where if you cut the wire, you lose all connection down the line. But with a mesh network, it actually, if you lose connection in a small area, it'll actually automatically route itself around that area. And if we wanted to replace the coverage, these devices are so small and light that we can replace them by drone deployment or with first responders as they're walking into the area, they can carry these devices and place them by hand.
Okay, we're going to pause here to recap how Project OWL works. So there are these little devices called ducts. They're set up all throughout a location. In this case, a location where a natural disaster might happen. They've got a battery, solar panels, and they can connect to one another to create a self-contained network. So, how do you log on to this network? Well, you know how when you go to Starbucks and you try to log on to their Wi-Fi, you get this page pop-up where you have to put in your information, usually your email, maybe a password? This works just like that. Only with this page pop-up, you're not connecting to Wi-Fi, you're connecting to the network. It allows people to send little bits of information to first responders who are also connected to the network. So far, none of these ducts are connected to the internet. They're just connected to each other. Until we get to the Papa duck. That's the one that's actually connected to Wi-Fi and allows the whole isolated network of ducts to be connected to the internet as well. Okay, back to the interview. So I know it also uses something called LoRa, L-O-R-A. What is that?
Yeah, so LoRa is a really interesting technology, and we chose it primarily for two reasons. One, it's extremely low power. So this means that we're able to operate entirely off of battery. And this is important because during a disaster where internet and cellular connectivity are down, but also power is down. So therefore, we won't have a reliable source of power during a disaster event. The other reason is also LoRa is extremely long range. And actually, that it's already in the name. LoRa stands for long range. And it's a radio. When I say long range, they're talking about each of our devices are able to reach up to 1.5 kilometers. In range. And there are other cases where we've been talking to other people in the space and where LoRa can even reach up to 10 kilometers.
Wow.
So it's a really powerful technology, but at the same time, it does come at a cost. You won't be streaming cat videos on LoRa. It's one of the drawbacks is that you have a lower data rate. But also at the same time, we also get a really interesting property where you don't need necessarily line of sight to get long distances. So kind of what I mean by this line of sight, if you imagine your Wi-Fi router, once you leave the house, you no longer have connection. With LoRa, you're actually able to pass through buildings. And so an example of this is actually when we're doing some testing in Brooklyn, we were able to be connected between devices, even through buildings multiple blocks away. So LoRa is a really powerful technology. We're kind of using it in a little bit of a different situation than what LoRa is normally used. It's extremely popular in the sensor space because of where you can have sensors sending data over LoRa and have them last for a year off of a battery. Really interesting technology and really powerful.
Is your company looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. The dev community is the go-to destination for developers to learn, connect, and support each other. You can share your message with the 15 million developers that visit every single month by using our powerful native advertising platform. To learn more, visit dev.to/advertise. So how did you learn about all these technologies? LoRa, the ducts, the mesh network. It sounds like there's a lot of technologies required to kind of make all this work. How did you learn about these?
Through hackathons. Really, that's where the first time I ever heard of LoRa was at a hackathon. It was more of a hardware-focused hackathon, but one of the sponsors for the event built LoRa gateways, and that was the first time I had ever gotten my hands on the technology. And the same thing with getting into hardware. I never took any hardware or electrical engineering classes. And the first time I ever did anything with a Raspberry Pi or anything like that was at a hackathon where I had this idea to build a robot. And I did it at a hackathon, figured it out. All the different technologies that we used were learned from previous hackathons and kind of just hacking it together into this one idea to solve a problem that we were really passionate about.
So we talked a lot about the hardware of Project Owl, but I want to talk a little bit about the software of it. What kind of coding was needed to make this thing work?
So on one side, we have the ducts, the cluster duct network. On the other side, we have the OWL. So OWL has two meanings for us. It's an acronym for operations, whereabouts, and logistics, but also it has a symbolic meaning where OWLs are really good at seeing in the dark. So we want to be the eyes that are able to see in the dark of a natural disaster. So the OWL platform acts as this tool for first responders to be able to visualize all the data that's coming in. So we use a bunch of different technologies. Currently, it's all built in Rails, but also we use a bunch of different IBM technologies, mainly IBM's IoT Hub, as well as Watson AI.
Very cool. And how did you learn to use these things?
So similarly, also from a hackathon. So this is from a hackathon that IBM sponsored and where it said, hey, check out our cloud technology and build something really cool. And so actually what's kind of interesting is that one of our co-founders, Brian and I have an interesting relationship because we actually were competitors at hackathons for a couple of years, where both of us are big hackathon veterans, I guess you could say. And because we went to so many hackathons, we would end up at the exact same hackathons very often. So we would end up competing against each other. And Brian, he actually would often use the IBM Watson because he was always interested in the NLP. This is a natural language processing at the hackathons for his solution. And so that's actually how it became one of the big parts of Project Owls that this is actually Brian and I's first time where we were working together. So kind of competitors coming together to build something even better.
So what is the ideal situation of using Project Owl? Walk me through once everything is set up, the ducks are in their right places. What does it look like?
So when everything is set up, what would happen is that after a disaster, survivors of the disaster will be able to open up their phones and connect to one of our Wi-Fi hotspots, be able to put in what's their situation, their name, phone number, location, as well as what their emergency is, whether it's they need food, water, or they're trapped or someone else is trapped. They'll be able to send that information. That message will be sent through our mesh network. And then once it gets to one of the ducts that's connected to the internet, it will send that information to our OWL platform, and it will appear like dots on a map for first responders. And so first responders can then, whether it be Red Cross, FEMA, or any other kind of organization involved in the disaster relief process, they'll be able to quickly identify where people are and what are the conditions like, so that when they do go in to rescue people, they are able to do it more efficiently and quickly.
But if there's a natural disaster, wouldn't the ducts be destroyed?
One of the great things about being a mesh network is that even if one of the devices goes down, it does not destroy the integrity of the network. Messages will actually route around where we might be missing connectivity. So therefore, we're still able to get messages. Now, if we wanted to restore coverage to the area where a duct is destroyed, our devices are so small and lightweight that we would actually be able to replace them using drone deployment.
So since ducts are essentially gathering a bunch of information, right? They're gathering my name, my location, potentially medical information if I'm reporting that I'm hurt or I'm sick. Are there any security concerns? What do you do with all of these potentially personally sensitive information?
Yeah, so that's a great point. And even though we're only sending messages the size of a tweet, all of it will be encrypted. And so all that information will be protected. So that's definitely a concern that we are addressing.
What was the most surprising thing you learned in working on Project Owl?
I mean, the thing is that, so kind of just to put it out there, the most kind of interesting thing or surprising or exciting about this whole process was the process of going from a hackathon project to going down that journey of turning this into something real and putting this technology in people's hands. And when we were in Puerto Rico, interacting with the community and saying, hey, we have this technology. If you had this during Hurricane Maria, would this have helped you? And how adamant people were. It's like, if I had this, this would really help me a lot in that situation. And just getting that kind of feedback was really powerful for us, where really we felt that we were on the right track and creating something that people needed. This is something that could actually save people's lives. And that really changed a lot for me.
And I know you have teammates, you have a couple other people that you're working with for Project Owl. What is the structure of it? Is it a nonprofit, a corporation? What is Project Owl?
Project Owl is a for-profit company.
So it's interesting that it's for profit, because I think it naturally feels like a nonprofit. You know, when you're thinking about disaster relief and organizations going to save lives, it feels like usually there's a nonprofit entity attached to that mission. So I'm interested to hear why you chose to go for profit. Why is that the better, the faster way of helping people?
We felt that operating as a for profit is that we felt that it allowed us to innovate really quickly, but also that there are other ways that we can use Project Owl's technology. For example, at music festivals, you have many people in a small area, which causes the cellular networks to become overcrowded. And so in this situation, similar to in a natural disaster where you need to call for help, you're no longer able to get in touch with the medical tents. So we would set up Project Owl during this music festival as a dedicated emergency network that people at the festival can always have a direct line to the medical tents to ask for help.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The other example I'm thinking of is maybe like conferences, sports events. There seem to be a lot of frankly, for-profit events that can use this technology. So when you go from this hackathon project to, an actual business, what does that process look like? Tell me about that journey.
Yeah, so when we were working on Call for Code, I was working as a junior back-end developer and didn't really know anything about business. So for me, I always was just interested in writing code and building something cool on weekends. All that changed after we won Call for Code. And I think for me, it's just been such an incredible experience where every day is something new. I have to be able to adjust and adapt to new situations. I write more emails and spreadsheets than I write code these days. At the same time, I've got to meet so many different people and learn so much from seeing the whole other aspect to technology, aside from just writing code, but also kind of working on how do you take that technology that's really cool and something that I'm really interested in, and how do I get it to the people who need it and the people who are going to use it? It changes your whole mindset of technology where you build something that's really cool, but now you have to think about exactly how do people use it. And for example, when we developed the technology, we didn't really think about this, but it was brought up to us. In a natural disaster, people are extremely stressed out. In a normal situation, they might be able to use technology. Well, what if they're extremely stressed out? How do you develop technology for someone who is stressed out? Or what if a child needs to use the technology? Are they able to figure out how to use it? And the thing is that when you turn it into a business, you start asking a lot of these different questions and have to change your perspective from this is really cool tech to thinking more objectively about the user. And something that also came out of this was responsible tech, kind of something that I personally didn't think too much about, but also this is something I think a lot of criticism for people who like about Silicon Valley were just building all these tech, but not really thinking about the people. And I think this is also something that was really interesting during this whole process was starting to think more about how do we build technology responsibly and how do we think more about the people that we're building the technology for rather than just building something cool.
Coming up next, Nick talks about the most important things to think about when building a project, even before you start to code, and the most surprising thing he's learned while building Project Owl after this. So for folks who want to build projects, build apps like you did, and help people in natural disasters and first response, what is the biggest piece of advice you have for them?
Biggest advice that I would give, and this is something I think that also if you're interested in going into hackathons, that's really important, is understanding the problem that you're trying to solve. For us, what we were trying to solve was how do we bring connectivity from 0% to 1%? How do we get the message out from a survivor to a first responder in a zone where they have no connectivity, no power or anything? How do we get that message to the first responder so that we can make disaster relief more efficient? It took us a while to really understand and craft Project Owl. And what was really great with IBM's Call for Code was that they brought in subject matter experts for disaster relief. One of these people was Roderick Bowman from Red Cross New Jersey. And it was really great to be able to have access to him to ask him questions about the disaster relief process and ask for, who can we talk to and bounce ideas off of him, as well as also asking other technologists about LoRa. One other group that if you're in the New York City area, you should definitely check them out, which is the Things Network New York City meetup group. We got to ask them questions and get a lot of help on our technology on how can we, presenting what the problem is and how do we use the technology and getting their ideas and feedback too.
Now, at the end of every episode, we ask our guests to fill in the blanks of three very important questions. Nick, are you ready to fill in the blanks?
Let's go for it.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is?
Well, whenever I'm asked about advice, it's not really that someone particularly gave to me. It's more of a quote that stuck with me for a long time. And it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. And it's a quote by Mario Andretti. And it's, if everything's under control, you're not moving fast enough.
Oh.
How I always interpreted it was kind of, always push your boundaries, never completely settle, which is really great for me. You know, if you think about going to these hackathons and trying new technology and going beyond what I was before. But also at the same time, it's a double-edged sword where if you bite off more than you can chew, where for me, it's like where I take on too many responsibilities and just for the sake of like, oh, I want to try all these things, where it becomes overwhelming, and don't go too far where you can't handle everything.
Number two, my first coding project was about?
Yeah, so my first coding project was creating a clone of Bowman, a popular game that on Newgrounds at the time. And what's interesting about this game, it's a two-player game where you take turns shooting an arrow at each other. Why I chose this game to clone was because it has this really interesting mechanic where you can't see the other player on the screen. And so you have to kind of guess, you know, what angle and how much power you need to use when you shoot the bow. And then you watch the arrow fly and you see it land whether or not you hit your friend or not. And so it's kind of an interesting challenge to how do I emulate that as well as like and do all the animation. So it was a really fun and interesting challenge. There's a lot of math also involved when creating it. So I was doing 3D calculus. So that was really fun.
Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is
that code is a blank canvas. You can create whatever you can think of.
Definitely. Thank you so much for being on the show and telling us all about Project Owl.
Thank you.
This episode was edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. You can reach out to us on Twitter at CodeNewbies or send me an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Join us for our weekly Twitter chats. We've got our Wednesday chats at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and our weekly coding check-in every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. For more info on the podcast, check out www.codenewbie.org/podcast. Thanks for listening. See you next week.